This is Ozarks at Large for Friday, January 4th, 2013. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Christina Thomas. Becoming a program sponsor on KUAF is a great way to introduce your business to our community. And you support your community at the same time by helping to bring our listeners the programs they enjoy. If you'd like more information on how underwriting works here at KUAF, just go to our website. It's KUAF.com. Or give our underwriting director, Rhonda Dillard, a call. Her number is 479-575-4441.
Ahead on the program, how the closure of a rural landfill has repercussions across the Ozarks. Jacqueline Froelich reports on the fallout from a decision to default on a landfill's revenue bond payments.
Plus, the great passion play in Eureka Springs is not gone after all. Timothy Dennis has the latest on efforts to keep the Eureka Springs attraction open. And Robert Ginsburg, host of KUAF's Shades of Jazz, has his picks for the best jazz recordings of 2012.
First, state tax revenue was up in December 2012. Economist John Shelnut with the Arkansas Department of Finance and Administration reports individual income tax collections grew 17.5% compared to the same month in 2011.
We still have some fluctuations occurring in refunds. Overall, I think we're looking at an economy and a revenue base that's growing at about 3.5% to 4%. And that's similar to what we're seeing in income figures for the state. And that's on an economy that's growing at about 1% in terms of net job growth.
Shelnut says revenue was up sharply by 7.6% on gross collections and by 9% on net collections. But officials are not expecting such high numbers for this month, January 2013.
Governor Mike Beebe announced yesterday that he would like legislators to resolve the Medicaid debate during the regular session rather than call a special session later. The scheduled session begins January 14th, but some are suggesting that the question of whether or not to expand Medicaid under the federal health care law should be saved for another time. Matt DeCampbell is the spokesperson for Governor Beebe.
When the governor was in the state Senate, he was a part of some special sessions in the 80s that went on for over a month and cost a lot of money and in some cases didn't accomplish anything. And he wants to avoid that kind of that cost to taxpayers. He'd rather get things done in the session that's already set aside.
The governor supports Medicaid expansion because it will bring insurance to 250,000 uninsured Arkansans, as well as provide economic stimulus.
Meanwhile, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services announced yesterday that Arkansas's request to operate a state partnership exchange has been approved. Secretary Kathleen Sebelius says with the new partnership, Arkansans will be able to easily purchase quality health insurance plans. 20 states have been approved for some model of the exchange, but spokesman Fabian Levy says that all models will benefit the insurance recipients.
The thing that's important to actually know for between a state-based exchange, a partnership exchange, and a federally facilitated exchange, actually, is that there's actually no difference at all in the way the consumer sees things. The consumer, whether, you know, the state, whichever route the state chooses, will be able to shop for insurance the exact same way, no matter which model the state chooses.
The new partnership and marketplace will take effect in 2014.
Fayetteville-based Mitchell Communications Group made a big announcement yesterday. The public relations firm, whose portfolio includes Walmart, Procter & Gamble, J.B. Hunt Transport, and Tyson Foods, has been acquired by global communications outfit Dentsu Network. The acquisition of Mitchell Communications is the first public relations acquisition by Dentsu, which is headquartered in New York and Tokyo and has 82 offices in 29 countries. As part of the acquisition, the headquarters for Mitchell Communications will remain in Fayetteville. CEO Elise Mitchell will continue in her role at the company in addition to joining the executive team and operating committee of Dentsu Network. And former executive vice president Sarah Clark has been named president of the agency. We'll have a conversation with Mitchell Communications founder Elise Mitchell on Monday's edition of Ozarks.
The Northwest Arkansas Children's Shelter is launching a new program aimed at making its facilities livelier looking for the children who find themselves in need of the shelter's services. Greg Russell is the shelter's director of marketing. He says the goal of the program is to conduct something of an extreme makeover for the residents' rooms at the shelter and to give them more of an inviting feel to children.
I was surprised at how much difference it made just putting different colors of paint on the wall. The first room that was adopted, I think it was like a tealish greenish color on one wall, and then there was a kind of a yellow ochre on another wall and a pink for a splash of bright color on another wall. And just the paint alone, nothing else done to the room, it's amazing how much more inviting, how much more kiddish atmosphere that it provided, and sort of a lighthearted atmosphere that it provided just putting that color on the walls.
Russell says three rooms have already been adopted, and the renovations done to those rooms have helped replace the somewhat colder institutional-feeling rooms with atmospheres that are warmer and more welcoming to the children. About 80% of the children who arrive at the shelter are victims of environmental neglect, which Russell defines as children who come from chaotic situations where their basic needs aren't being met.
So you can imagine they probably haven't had the room of their dreams coming out of an environment like that. So what we're hoping that this will do, and what we think it will do, is facilitate the healing process so that the room where they spend so much time, where they sleep, where they do their homework, is a room that is inviting, is a room that is decorated with kids in mind, so that it will have a part in lifting their spirits and starting that emotional healing that needs to take place, and just creating an environment that is conducive to that healing that needs to take place.
Almost any individual or group can volunteer to adopt a room. Russell says without the generosity of the community, the shelter couldn't exist, as the center must raise about 80% of its annual budget from volunteers.
Fees for camping at developed campgrounds along the Buffalo National River may increase in coming months. According to a release by the National Park Service, the proposed fee increase will affect 8 campgrounds, including Buffalo Point, Carver, Irby, Kyle's Landing, Ozark, Rush, Steel Creek, and Tyler Bend. Rates for sites with electrical hookups at Buffalo Point would increase from $17 to $25, while fees for non-electrical sites will expand with expanded amenities would increase from $12 to $17. The fee for camping at basic sites would increase from $10 to $15. The Buffalo National River justifies the proposed increase as a way to offset increased fuel costs for park staff and expanded electrical usage at Buffalo Point. The last fee increases were instituted a decade ago.
Tonight, overcast conditions, a 30% chance of rain or snow after midnight, lows in the mid-30s. Tomorrow in northwest Arkansas, 30% chance of snow, high around 46. It's a 20% chance of light snow tomorrow morning for the Arkansas River Valley, highs eventually hitting near 50. And for Saturday night, clear, lows from 23 in northwest Arkansas to around 30 tomorrow night for the River Valley. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me on the phone from his mobile office is Michael Tilley. He is the editor and publisher of thecitywire.com. It's a new year, and you're off and running, aren't you?
Well, we're trying to be off. We don't have a choice. This news business, no one stops the press release machine, so we have to keep going.
Well, we've just come through what is traditionally one of the slower, if not the slowest, news cycle of any year. That's the Christmas to New Year holiday, but still plenty of items on the City Wire over the last few days, including looking back at how sales went for retailers in December.
Right. I mean, you're right. Typically, it is a slow time of the year, but it hasn't been this year. But it appears that holiday sales are up across the board in some categories as much as double digits, 16-something percent. Now, it depends, though, on what kind of retailer you were. Some of the more lower-end discount retailers did well. Groups like Target, though, retailers like Target, didn't do that well. In fact, they missed some of their sales targets. Wholesale Club, Sam's, Costco, those type of folks did well. And I think what the numbers may tell us, Kyle, is that people were really doing their business or their Christmas shopping on a pretty tight budget. So those discount retailers who were better positioned to target those folks and to provide better deals, lower costs, that type of thing, did well over the holiday season.
Now, there's also a report on thecitywire.com that the trend that has been taking place for a while continues, and that's online Christmas business went up again this year.
Right, and you're right. That was not a surprise. I think it started out. Ended up at about 14% growth for the year, and that begins from the start of the day after Thanksgiving, official start of Christmas shopping, and it's started up around 16-18% growth, but then the closer you got to Christmas, And the more news there was out there about the economy, about the fiscal cliff, a lot of that online shopping and shopping in general, or spending in general, slowed down. But yes, online continues to grow. It's just a matter now. Kim Susan and I, our Northwest Arkansas editor, we were talking about, you know, what year is it going to be when online is greater than bricks and mortar spending? And, you know, you wouldn't have had that even thought 3 or 4 years ago, but it's really blossomed.
And something that brick and mortar and local retailers have to think about.
Right. And now the upside of that is, you know, some brick and mortar folks have found ways to partner with people who can provide online. And they get a cut of the deal, so to speak. And I think we may see more of that going forward, where that brick and mortar folks, instead of having to have all of their inventory in their shop for Christmas, they can keep it at a location. They're not paying for the shipping, that type of thing. They just manage the product, and if it's sold online, they make sure they get it to their customer.
You mentioned earlier the fiscal cliff. We haven't jumped off quite yet. Still many things to be resolved between now and some point. But one of the details that came out of the agreement Congress, both the House and Senate, passed doesn't really help, as some people hoped it would, Mitsubishi's plant at Fort Chaffee open.
Right. You know, the Congress did extend the production tax credits, and that provides a certain level of tax credit based on the type of products built. And in wind energy, it's based on kilowatt production. But long story short, no, it did not open the Mitsubishi plant. It extended that credit to 2014. There are a couple of problems, though, for Mitsubishi. One, not that they're problems, they're factors for Mitsubishi, but one, a lot of folks in the wind energy say you can't just extend it 1 year. That's not people make purchasing decisions, these things, to get these wind farms up and going. It's not just a one-year deal. You need security. You need to know that the tax credit is going to be in place for longer than a year. So that's an issue. And the other issue is Mitsubishi has said this in the past, and they're not wavering, is they are not moving forward, and they're not going to be aggressive in the wind energy industry in the U.S. until they get some resolution to their ongoing legal battle with General Electric. They still have patent disputes, several court cases pending. I think they may still have an issue before a trade commission, the International Trade Commission. So there's still a lot up in the air, and these are legal issues that have been going on now for 2 or 3 years, and there's no light at the end of the legal tunnel, so to speak, for these. So that's the hang-up. I had a lot of people call when the fiscal cliff went through, because a lot of folks are watching that for obvious reasons. And I don't think anything Congress is going to do is going to help the Mitsubishi thing. They're going to have to get resolution to these legal disputes.
Hmm. Also, a new development in the past few days about the Walmart bribery scandal that has continued to be in the headlines.
Right. We have a new legal counsel has stepped up to represent, and they're representing a retirement fund, the City of Pontiac, a retirement fund. But this is just another example of this issue not going away for Walmart. And I wouldn't be surprised if 2013 is the year that we see the end of all of this. At some point, Walmart's going to want to try to settle this and get it behind, I would think, settle it, get it behind it, and move on. Now, the counter-argument to that is, well, it hasn't hurt their share price. It's hit record share prices
right.
In 2013. Their same-store sales are still doing well. And as long as they don't have to spend that much more money on the legal. Now, they've spent a lot of money, 35-something, $40 million. They've spent a crazy amount of money on this. But I still think they want to get it behind them. They're going to have more come out in this year. I guess it already is 2013 on some of the issues with their suppliers. They had the Bangladesh factory fire that killed several hundred folks, and it's where Walmart clothing apparel was once made. So I think they're going to have some of those issues too, and they don't want to see these pile up on them.
Finally, it is that time of year when quorum courts and mayors and city boards and city councils are sworn in for new or renewed terms. Such was the case at the Fort Smith Board of Directors. I bring that up because perhaps more than any other municipal entity in our area, It was a tumultuous 2012 for the board of directors, and I wonder what's ahead for them in 2013.
You know, Kyle, back in 2010, I thought I was clever enough to have some type of insight into what the Fort Smith board of directors may or may not do, and I can't believe how stupid I was to ever think anybody could figure out what that board could do, but I don't know. We do have Keith Law, and we have Mike Lorenz, two board members. In terms of them talking about not micromanaging, trying to get the board back onto the big picture view, I have high hopes, but I don't know. You know, tumultuous is a kind word, I think. You know, we went back and forth on the trash issue, and finally it took a citizen to get a petition forth to put something on the ballot to put an end to the nonsense. I mean, that's a lot of trouble just to get, you know, and to get automated trash, which communities have been doing since the 60s, to get automated trash, you know, wholly in place in Fort Smith. So now we've got this animal ordinance that's going on. And in the meantime, you're having plants shut down. You're having the jobless numbers go up. Let's hope 2013 is the year that they get focused on big picture stuff.
Well, let's hope 2013 has plenty for people in the news business to cover, but nothing that's too dangerous. How's that?
Right. Yes, I'm tired of reporting on plant closing, so let's hope this is the year there are no plant closing announcements.
Michael Tilley is the editor and publisher of thecitywire.com. Michael, thank you for your time.
Always. Thank you, Kyle.
I'm Bob Garfield. On this week's On the Media, a special look at privacy and surveillance.
If you want to say something to someone that's very personal, pick up the phone and call them, or say it in person. The internet is a giant copy machine. Anything you put on the internet can be copied and sent around. I just hope you have nice friends.
Don't miss this week's On the Media from WNYC.
On the Media, Sunday morning at 11 on KUAF, 91.3 FM. In about 5 minutes on Ozarks, a shift in landfill operations in the rural Ozarks is creating concern for many people.
The Great Passion Play has been open in Eureka Springs since 1967, and since then, more than 6 million people have seen the performance. In the fall, the Passion Play seemed headed for closure, and foreclosure was approaching. Now, as Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis reports, an effort has allowed the foreclosure to not happen. But the money raised so far is far from what is needed to make sure the production has a future beyond 2013.
The gates to the Great Passion Play grounds were shuttered and the lights at the Christ of the Ozarks statue were darkened a month ago as the Elma M. Smith Foundation, which produced the play since its debut in 1967, faced foreclosure on the Passion Play's assets. But in the 11th hour, followers of the Passion Play saga stepped in. 10 days before Cornerstone Bank was set to take over the property, a fundraising effort was launched by Randall Christie, a pastor and president of the Gospel Station Radio Network based in Ada, Oklahoma.
There's just something about seeing it live. You can watch it on a movie or hear a great story or sermon, but it's just not the same as seeing someone crucified before your very eyes. And it has a dramatic impact on people's lives when they see that. And, you know, 7.6 million people have seen it. It's something that's become a Christian American icon. And it's just a tragedy to allow that to go away. And I've just really, in my heart, I've felt very strongly that the Lord does not want that to go away.
So Christie used his available resources, including a website and a network of 21 terrestrial radio stations across Oklahoma, Tennessee, and Mississippi, to raise $75,000 to make an interest payment to Cornerstone Bank on outstanding loans against the Great Passion Play. Bank CEO Charlie Cross says that the play was subject to 3 loans that had payments due at the beginning of this year.
When the play finished its season in the fall, I think it was pretty imminent and pretty obvious to them out there that the resources, financially speaking, weren't going to be available to meet those obligations come January. So that's what prompted all this, is they approached us and basically knew from a budgetary standpoint that there wasn't going to be the necessary finances to meet those debt obligations.
As soon as this realization hit the presses, that's when Christie and his ministry stepped up. He says that people from across the nation donated money to help save the Great Passion Play.
We have had gifts from California, Florida, Mississippi, Kansas, Texas, Minnesota. It's amazing it's how widespread it was. The largest number of donors came from Arkansas. The largest amount of money came from Oklahoma. And I think that's indicative because, well, it's indicative of the Passion Play's influence in Arkansas and the Gospel Station Network's influence in Oklahoma.
But the fundraising hurdles are not over yet.
They've got to find a way to get open, find the funding to sustain it, to improve it, to enhance it, you know, keep it capitalized and service the debt moving forward and all the challenges that go along with, you know, running such a production and such a campus out there. So, yeah, there is a lot of work still yet to be done, and this was no small feat, but in the grand scheme of things, this was just a very small step that they had to take to, in order to have a chance to take the bigger steps. So there's a lot of work and a lot of effort that's still got to be made, so we're kind of on the tip of the iceberg a little bit in that regard.
And the next step for the Great Passion Play is indeed more fundraising. Christie says that $200,000 will need to be raised before they can open its 2013 season in May.
The season will open, but we really need to raise $200,000 either through ticket sales or donations or corporate sponsorships to get it off the ground and to make it better. We're going to be looking for ways to improve the special effects. We're going to be looking for some modern approaches to telling the same story. But this first year, most likely we will just tweak the show that was run last year. And during that time, we will be investigating ways that we can drastically improve it next year.
In the meantime, Christie says that tickets for the Great Passion Play's 2013 season will likely go on sale in the coming days. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Timothy Dennis.
This is Ozarks at Large. A landfill and waste hauling company operated by the Ozark Mountain Regional Solid Waste District was shut down in late November after its long-embattled board voted to default on the landfill's revenue bond payments. As Ozark's Jacqueline Froelich reports, the default not only places district members at possible risk for financial liability, the abandoned facility poses an environmental hazard.
In Arkansas, we have 18 regional solid waste management districts regulated and monitored by the Arkansas Department of Environmental Quality, charged with managing municipal and county solid waste recycling and illegal dumping. We also have 43 active landfills in Arkansas, but only three are permitted on the ecologically sensitive Ozark Highlands in Washington, Baxter, and Fulton counties. In late November, one of them, the Baxter County landfill, called Neighbors Landfill, was closed down. Neighbors was the realization of a vision for a centralized landfill and hauling service financed 7 years ago with municipal revenue bonds by the Ozark Mountain Regional Solid Waste District, which serves Baxter, Boone, Carroll, Marion, Newton, and Searcy counties, the most rugged real estate in Arkansas. But after struggling with a landfill, which was too ecologically complex and expensive to manage, the district board voted in early November to abandon it. We're at Methvin Sanitation Transfer Station on Harmon Road, north of Harrison, which serves a five-county region. 5 days a week, garbage trucks pull in here to offload trash into large open trailers for transport to the local landfill. Methvin Sanitation had been hauling its solid waste 50 miles northeast to the now-defunct Baxter County Neighbors Landfill. Instead, haulers must drive twice the distance to a landfill northeast in Fulton County. Harrison Mayor Jeff Crockett, elected several years ago, has been chair of the Ozark Mountain Regional Solid Waste District since late 2011. He voted to default on Neighbors Landfill.
My thinking at that point in time was that there possibly was enough left to attract a management company that could successfully come in and possibly salvage the deal.
It all started 10 years ago when the district, then called the Northwest Arkansas Regional Solid Waste District, purchased the Baxter County Class 1 landfill, then operated by RLH Corporation near Mountain Home. Although the 20-year-old landfill had been plagued by chronic mismanagement, the board was confident it could make it work. But Mayor Jeff Crockett, a board freshman, said had he been there, he would have voted against the purchase.
Why would anybody in their right mind go into an environmental nightmare that had just been fined $250,000 and give them $8 million for it? We borrowed $12 million. And the $4 million difference was supposed to fix the problems. They've never touched the problems. The problems are all still there.
The $12 million was secured via revenue bonds, municipal bonds that finance income-producing projects rather than general obligation bonds, which are payable with public tax money. The district projected that if all members, all district members, complied with the so-called flow agreement to haul their waste to neighbors, that revenue would help pay off the bond within 15 years. But Harrison Mayor Jeff Crockett said the board from the beginning was conflicted about how to operate it.
The board has been divided and has over and over in the past refused to agree on hiring a management company that was qualified to come in there and manage a landfill. The board has proved over the years that they are not qualified to manage a landfill.
Especially a landfill situated on sensitive karst terrain, which posed expensive ecological challenges, including groundwater contamination and methane gas emissions, all of which required mitigation and containment. ADEQ has issued several consent administrative orders against the district, warning certain landfill pits or cells were at or over capacity and more space is required. Monitoring wells also needed to be installed. As a consequence, the board had to raise the cost of using the landfill, so-called tipping fees, to cover expenses. Private haulers stopped using it. And amazingly, even members of the Ozark Mountain Regional Solid Waste District who own it chose to contract with less expensive landfills up in Missouri, Western Washington County, and even the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma. Only Baxter and Boone County Waste Districts, Mountain Home and Harrison, continued to use neighbors' landfill until it closed. Harrison Mayor Jeff Crockett said the Ozark Mountain Solid Waste District, in the end, failed to do the legwork to make neighbors profitable by enforcing in-district flow control and ensuring outside trash contracts.
And it's been several of the board members' opinions over the years that outside trash is worse than our trash, I guess.
Another thing that puzzles Mayor Crockett, again a Solid Waste District board newcomer, is that the original RLH landfill had been appraised at $4.3 million, yet the district borrowed more than $12 million in revenue bonds.
In looking at these bonds, if I was an investor, they were pretty much junk bonds.
The district owes, according to the most recent audit, more than $11.2 million on the bonds, plus an additional $1.8 million in short-term debt and leases, some of which has since been paid down. Last spring, evidently seeing the writing on the wall, the Ozark Mountain Waste District Board attempted to sell the landfill. Several national waste management companies took a look, said Mayor Crockett, including Waste Management and Progressive Waste Solutions.
And all of them ran away.
Trash is a funny thing. None of us want it around. But those in the solid waste business know it can be incredibly lucrative if conditions are just right, says Bill Lord. He's former solid waste program coordinator for the Northwest Arkansas Economic Development District in Harrison, a contract administrator for the Ozark Mountain Solid Waste District. He was present in 2002 when the previous landfill owners, RLH, were looking to sell their impaired site.
So we saw this as a real plum. There was about 200 acres along with it. We realized that in the hands of a large waste management company, that they could bring in garbage from St. Louis, Chicago, anywhere that they wanted to. And you remember years ago, people tried to bring garbage in to Arkansas from New York City. So it was within the realm of possibility. We also knew that to own and operate a landfill and to have control over the end use of that material, that we could enhance recycling, we could enhance, make sure that the landfill was environmentally sound, environmentally safe.
Lord says because of its relationship with the Northwest Arkansas Economic Development District, the Regional Solid Waste Board was able to secure the necessary loans and revenue bonds for their project. He also pushed the board to hire a company to install a methane collection system and to contract with Santec Waste Services, based in Cleveland, Tennessee, to manage the landfill and hauling business.
They manage only public landfills. They don't own landfills. They don't own hauling companies. They only provide management services. They bring capital to the table. They have efficiencies of scale that we don't have. For example, they could have cut the construction costs quite a bit because they don't make any profit off the construction itself. They do it with their own people.
Santec, which manages landfill projects across a 9-state area, drew up a proposal. Board members from Baxter and Carroll counties blocked it to maintain local control. Baxter County board member Mountain Home Mayor Dave Osmond declined commenting for this report. In 2009, the Ozark Mountain Waste District terminated its contract with the Northwest Arkansas Economic Development District as well. Bill Lord, now a freelance consultant with Lord's Environmental, was dedicated, he said, to making the neighbor's acquisition a success.
Had we been able and allowed to continue, we would not even be in this situation right now. We would have had a management company with capital on the table that would have done it. We would have the environmental issues taken care of. The contamination issues would have been cleaned up, and we wouldn't even be having this conversation.
Bill Lord speculates that certain board members wanted the landfill to fail in order to sell it off and get out from under the bond obligation. But board members like Carroll County Waste District Director Phil Jackson and Berryville Mayor Tim McKinney deny this. Both men declined talking on tape. But Mayor McKinney, former Ozark Solid Waste District Chair, did say he supported the hiring of Santec Waste Services all along. In an attempt to salvage the mess, the Ozark Mountain Waste District Board voted in mid-December to have Cruz and Associates Investment Banking in Little Rock, the original revenue bond broker, along with the bond trustee, Bank of the Ozarks, and trustee council, push one last time for outside management or quick sale of a neighbor's landfill. A senior managing director at Cruz submitted a final plea to Santec Waste Services. Harrison Mayor Jeff Crockett read verbatim the angry response by Santec's director of development, David Klein.
I can't see any opportunity for Santec to take on an environmentally challenged and financially raped landfill that is closed. We have reached out to this district board on too many occasions and offered plausible plans that have been totally disregarded and played against other proposers. Again, should my assumptions of the current status of neighbors be wrong, please advise me. Otherwise, as they say on the popular TV show Shark Tank, we're out.
How much the Ozark Mountain Waste District Board is currently seeking for the neighbor's landfill and hauling company has not been disclosed, nor do we know who's responsible for the $12 million in outstanding bonds and short-term debt on the operation. The bonds are not insured, according to a source with Cruz and Associates. The bondholders are a mix of private investors and financial institutions. Cruz and Associates declined talking on the record. An attorney representing several interested parties, as well as the Bank of the Ozarks, the trustee for the revenue bonds, did respond to a query for this report, but also said he could not comment at this time. The default is reportedly the first of its kind in this state of Arkansas. And who's responsible for the shuttered landfill? Late last year, the Ozark Mountain Solid Waste District Board requested that ADEQ take over the perpetual care of neighbors' landfill. But in an email response for this report, ADEQ spokesperson Catherine Beninati said the district, as permit holder, will be held legally and financially responsible for the abandoned landfill's closure, as well as post-closure maintenance and monitoring. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
January 4th, 2013. It's always hard, right?
It is hard to get into the cycle of it.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
And here with us, who is always dismayed at the passage of time, perhaps even more so when it's a new year, is Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Well, the new years are easy. It's how everything flies by in between.
Oh, really? So yeah. This is okay?
Yeah.
Oh, all right.
Go
even
figure.
Though it's already 2013.
Yeah.
Okay.
You just have to do like the little piece of art I saw on Facebook and remember to make your twos into threes.
Yes.
Right. So we have a new division of events today.
Oh?
It may not be entirely new, but we haven't done it for a while. We have events for adults and events for bored children.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Who won't be bored much longer.
Good.
Okay. So today and tomorrow at the Bentonville Public Library, an exhibit called Ikebana, Living Flowers, Living Art.
This is done by a Bentonville High School graduate, I believe.
Stephen Kohler. I'm sure it's amazing, and it will be on display from 10 to 4 today and tomorrow. There's country music this weekend. As Kevin Kinder, our music writer, puts it, the rising country star behind the song Cowboys and Angels will be at George's Majestic Lounge in Fayetteville on Saturday. His name is Dustin Lynch.
Okay.
He had a new self-titled album in August and has just released the album's second single, She Cranks My Tractor.
Oh,
okay. Oh,
I kind of like that title.
Tickets are $15 for the 9 o'clock show on Saturday at George's. Now, this is more my style. A cabaret punk rock sensation.
Mm-hmm.
Coming from Little Rock, their name is Flaming Death Fairies.
I have heard of them, yes.
And there's nothing about that that's spelled any way resembling English.
Right.
They will be at Smoke and Barrel Tavern in Fayetteville at 10 o'clock on Sunday.
Okay.
And admission is free. And on Tuesday, Catch Me If You Can opens at the Walton Arts Center.
Indeed it does.
I haven't seen the movie.
I have.
So will it be fun? Of course, it's a musical.
Yes.
I'm curious to see how they turn this kind of chase movie into a musical.
Right.
The actor that Kevin Kinder talked to said it actually works better as a musical.
So okay.
We'll see. It'll be interesting.
Okay, we'll see.
Opens on Tuesday, shows 8 shows through next Sunday. Tickets start at $39 at 443-5600. Now for kids.
Mm-hmm.
It's first Saturday tomorrow at the Bella Vista Library at 10:30.
So what happens on
Stories,
first Saturday?
Stories, crafts, fun, games.
Okay.
Non-boredom.
Right.
There's a breakfast and anime station at 11, from 11 to 1 on Saturday at the Fayetteville Public Library. Zumba for kids and families at 2 o'clock Saturday at the Springdale Public Library. And it's about time for the spring session of Serendipity for students at the Art Center of the Ozarks in Springdale. A lot of people who don't have kids in school never know this happens. They've been doing it most of the 46 years they've been in business,
mm-hmm.
that they have a special lineup just for kids, all the way from elementary through high school. And sometimes there is no adult performance of the show.
Oh.
So the first one, which happens on Thursday, is the Cimarron Opera Company from Norman, Oklahoma, and they'll be doing a show called Fumbleena.
Fumbleena?
Yes.
A clumsy fumbleena?
Yes.
I was thinking of football playing fumbleena.
Oh. Let it go.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then there'll be the senior high art competition and some locally produced events like Go Dog Go that the ACO will be doing later this spring. So you can find out more about that at 751-5441.
Okay.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Lisa O'Donnell says her new book is appropriate for some 15-year-olds, but certainly a story about burying your parents in the backyard is shocking.
It's not a nice thing to say, but young girls do fantasize about the absence of their own parents, wishing they weren't around.
The Death of Bees is the title of Lisa O'Donnell's book, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
You can listen to Weekend Edition tomorrow morning from 7 to 9 right here on KUAF. In just a couple of minutes, Robert Ginsberg discusses his favorite jazz recordings of 2012.
Yesterday, the organizers of the annual music festival Wakarusa announced the first wave of acts signed to play at Mulberry Mountain in the spring. The initial list of bands created quite a stir among fans. Widespread Panic, a band known for its passionate live performances and equally passionate fan base, will be on stage for the festival's 10th anniversary year. Also announced to perform yesterday, the Icelandic band of Monsters and Men. Their CD, My Head is an Animal, was one of the best-received CDs by critics last year. Other bands included in yesterday's announcement, Yonder Mountain String Band, Sunvolt, Mountain Sprout, and RJD2. There will be two more rounds of lineup revelations. The next is Thursday, and the final parts of the Wakarusa 2013 lineup will be announced on January 17th. Observers are expecting some more big names to be included before the full lineup has been assembled. You can learn more at wakarusa.com.
None of the artists included on Robert Ginsberg's list of the best jazz of 2012 are on the agenda for Wakarusa, but don't fret. Their music is widely available to be heard. Robert, the host of KUAF Shades of Jazz every Friday and Saturday night at 10, gives us his choices for his favorite jazz of the just completed year.
2012 was noteworthy not only because we avoided the end of the world and falling off the fiscal cliff. More importantly, it was a great year for jazz recordings. And I'd like to feature some of my top picks for the year 2012. I actually have four recordings I'd like to share with you. Two great trio recordings and two recordings from great women in jazz. Brad Meldow has released two noteworthy CDs in 2012 with his trio, one entitled Ode and the other Where Do You Start, both on the Nonesuch label. Meldow's produced a body of trio recordings over the years that really rivals the legendary work of Bill Evans and Keith Jarrett. With longtime bandmates Larry Grenadier on double bass and Jeff Ballard on the drums, Meldow continues to display remarkable facility and imagination. Where Do You Start comprises the trio's interpretation of 10 tunes by other composers, along with one Meldow original. Here's the trio's take on South American composer Toninho Horta's tune, Aqui Es Coisas Todas. Another trio recording from 2012, but with a much different groove, comes from the pianist Vijay Iyer. The American-born son of Indian immigrants and a 2011 Grammy nominee, Iyer was described by the Village Voice as the most commanding pianist and composer to emerge in recent years, and by the New Yorker as one of today's most important pianists. Iyer has developed an original sound and really his own conceptual world. His music is both compelling and challenging. In addition to intricate originals, Iyer covers songs by Duke Ellington, Henry Threadgill, and Flying Lotus, instantly making them his own. Here's a snippet of the title track from the 2012 release by Iyer, Accelerando. Alto saxophonist Grace Kelly has performed over 500 concerts as a leader all around the world at prominent venues such as the Montreal Jazz Festival, the Newport Jazz Festival, Lincoln Center, Carnegie Hall, the Kennedy Center, Apollo Theater, Birdland, Boston Symphony Hall, Dizzy's Club Coca-Cola, and Ronnie Scott's in London, not to mention a vast array of venues as far away as Europe and Asia. Grace Kelly became the youngest ever musician voted to the Downbeat magazine's critics poll at age 16, and she just turned 20 last year. Her CD, Live at Scullers, features not only her amazing saxophone virtuosity, but also her vocal talents. Incidentally, Grace Kelly will be appearing with her quartet on February the 16th in Star Theater at Walton Arts Center. Here's Kelly, live at Scullers, the legendary jazz club in Boston, playing the jazz standard, The Way You Look Tonight. ¶¶ Finally, on my list of the best jazz recordings from 2012, a vocal tour de force from Brazilian singer and composer Luciana Souza. Souza is a singer and a songwriter who defies category. Her singing has been called transcendental, and her recordings have garnered fans all over the globe. The Book of Chet and Duos 3 are her two offerings from 2012. Both records have been nominated for a Grammy. The Book of Chet as Best Jazz Vocal Record and Duos 3 as Best Latin Jazz Record. The Book of Chet is an introspective exploration of the singing of Chet Baker. Recorded live with a trio, it showcases Luciana's singing American standards associated with the late trumpet player Chet Baker. From the Book of Chet, here's Luciana singing the Julie Stein and Sammy Kahn tune, I Fall in Love Too Easily.
I fall in love too easily. I fall in love too fast. I fall in love too terribly hard. For love to
these are but a few of the great recordings that came out in 2012 in the world of jazz. Tonight on my show, Shades of Jazz, I will feature nothing but releases from 2012, including vocalist Gregory Porter, Keith Jarrett, Ravi Coltrane, Pat Metheny, Kurt Elling, and much, much more. Thanks for listening.
Robert Ginsberg is the host of KUAF's Shades of Jazz every Friday and Saturday night beginning at 10. He's also the founder of the Northwest Arkansas Jazz Society. More can be learned about that organization at digjazz.com.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, and Alpena.
Alpena.
Yes.
Home of the Leopards.
Home of the Leopards.
Yes.
See, I didn't know that, but...
Well, if you had grown up in North Central Arkansas, you probably would have played them in basketball occasionally.
Oh, so you did then.
Yes. And, well, I didn't play basketball. I was short and slow. But Mountain Home would often play Alpena. And because Mountain Home was a bigger school and Alpena was a smaller school, it was huge. They had much more to gain. You know,
right.
It was usually our first game of the year, mm-hmm. but the non-football playing schools back then would start playing basketball in like October. So it was like their 15th
game. Because basketball was their sport.
Right.
Right.
And they would just run us up and down the floor.
Well. I've driven through Alpena twice in the last couple of weeks, so I thought I'd, you know, give him a shout out.
And of course, there's the chainsaw carving place there.
I don't know that either.
On the curve, if you're heading east, right?
Okay,
across 412 there, and you look on your right at the curve, there is a chainsaw carving shop. A husband and wife. I talked to them briefly once. I stopped by. Maybe I'll do a piece sometime for Ozarks. But they chainsaw. Their specialty, apparently, is big feet.
Okay.
Sculptures of Bigfoot.
I like it.
All right.
I like it.
Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
You'll be with folks Sunday morning at 9 for Weekend Ozarks.
I will.
You'll be on Monday.
Yes, I will.
You and I will be back Tuesday.
Yep, we will.
Get my money's worth out of you this week, I tell you what. Thank you, Christina.
Thank you.
Have a good weekend.
Yes, happy Friday.
Happy Friday indeed. And if you'll indulge me for just a moment, just a bit of personal business. Last week, my father, Donald L. Kellums, died suddenly. Because of his generous nature, I'm in radio, something I love dearly. When I was just a teenager, I was given a job at KTLO Radio in Mountain Home, an amazing opportunity for a 16-year-old high school junior. The only problem was the studios were about 15 miles from my home in rural Lakeview, and I had no car, no driver's license even. My father, always an encouraging presence, would drive me to and from the station often. While many of my duties at KTLO involved monitoring St. Louis Cardinal games or writing small news stories, I was able to be a rock and roll DJ every Sunday night on the AM station. That was every Sunday night from 6 until midnight. My dad would get off work sometime Sunday evening and then drive in to pick me up when my on-air shift was over. Often he would call ahead just to let me know he hadn't fallen asleep and was on his way. I would ask if he had a request. Sometimes he said no. Other times he might ask for Gordon Lightfoot or another mellower artist. But he often asked to hear a newer song. Well, it was newer then. The Tide is High, a reggae song that had just been re-recorded and released by Blondie. He loved that song, and I would play it almost every Sunday night between 11:30 and midnight as a signal to him during his drive from Lakeview to Mountain Home. I'll end this edition of Ozarks with the song as a salute and a thank you to one of my all-time biggest supporters.